You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the verdict's in on Donald Sterling. At least the verdict over at Fox News and on the Rush Limbaugh show. Over at Fox News, clearly he was set up. This from Fox and Friends.
Going to be taken. There's no question about it.
So, Donald, I'm looking at a lot of our emails. Says, hey, it's a private conversation. You know, you now can't somebody, and she was baiting him. Do you fight this? Something like.
Yeah, and Donald Trump calling her the girlfriend from hell. And then Rush Limbaugh saying, well, everybody knew this. It's because this guy, he gave a $2,000 donation to Gray Davis back 10 years ago. And 15 years ago, he gave $4,000 to Bill Bradley when he was a Democrat. The guy's a big Democrat. Right. This is the response of the right wing. Joe Madison on the line with us, the host of the Joe Madison Show on Sirius XM weekdays, 6 to 10 a.m. on Channel 110. JoeMadison.com, of course, his website. Joe, how are you?
Oh, I'm just amazed. At first I've heard the response from Fox and Limbaugh. I haven't really been listening, nor do I usually. And I'm just absolutely flabbergasted. But you know what? I figured out, Tom, somebody, one of these conservative talk show personalities that you rumble with, you know, once a year at the at Michael Harrison's event, said that one of his Ten Commandments as it relates to political warfare is to never admit or give in to the premise of your opponent. How stupid. I don't know how one can even engage an intelligent debate or argument if you won't, if you're going to hold on to your premise, forget the facts. Like, for example, you know, the reason that the tapes were made is that Sterling asked for the tapes to be made. He asked his girlfriend to make the tapes to help him remember some of the things he said as it relates to business and conversations.
Which makes you wonder if he's early Alzheimer's and knows it.
That might be, we don't know, but that could very well be the case. So this wasn't a setup. And then as far as Rush Limbaugh is concerned, as typical Rush Limbaugh, he only gives half the story. This is a man who, you know, like a lot of oligarchians, you know, they don't give a damn about a Republican or a Democrat. They just contribute money to both parties as he has. I mean, so.
Apparently, he gave a very, very small contribution a long time ago. Very small contributions to two Democrats. I think Limbaugh is blowing in their defense.
Exactly.
Just so that the record is clear. Both Donald Trump on Fox, when he was asked that question, he said the comments were deplorable, and Limbaugh said the comments are deplorable, and both of them called the comments racist.
Maybe they're coming around because this makes for a very interesting the 2 weeks we've had with Bundy.
Mm-hmm.
But here's what really bothers me. First of all, Limbaugh's right. Why are we surprised? This is a guy who said he wanted to run a basketball team like a southern plantation where he would hire four southern black boys to be headed by a white coach. And he also said to a potential coach, what makes you think you can coach a bunch of niggas? I mean, and he got one of the largest fines from HUD as it relates to racial discrimination in not renting apartments to Hispanics, African Americans. He referred to them publicly as stinky people, didn't want families with children. And yet he gets to have a team all these years. And I can't believe that owners and people who are close to this man, don't know what he's been like. And the reality is that sponsors are now veiling. I think that, you know, but, you know, here's the other thing, and I'll just finish my part here. They're talking about they should, he should sell the team.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I don't know, quite honestly, because he bought that team, if I'm not mistaken, for $15 million. If he sold the team today, he would make over $1 billion.
Yeah, that's quite a profit.
And so that would be a profit.
Yeah.
So what a profit, and I could see him laughing all the way to the bank.
So, Joe, you know, I think this raises a large, this whole Cliven Bundy and Sterling, all this stuff raises a larger issue that maybe we can take a shot at in the 3 minutes or so we've got left here. And that is, the Supreme Court has essentially said we live in a post-racial society. The Republican Party is taking that position. The Supreme Court has done it both with regard to voting rights and affirmative action at the University of Michigan. Doesn't this give the lie to that?
Yeah, it does give a lie to it. We live in an improved, an improved racial society, but not a post-racial society. Even during the Brown versus Board of Education decision, the issue was not only de jure segregation, but de facto segregation.
Right.
And that's the problem. It's hard to change attitudes. And the problem when you don't change attitudes, such as the Republican Party, they act legislatively on these attitudes. That's why they go after voter ID laws when there's no problem with voter fraud. That's why they go after the 1965 Voting Rights Act, because I've said it, I'll say it again, these aren't true conservatives, the ones that we used to debate up in Michigan when we both lived there. Milliken, remember him?
Oh, yeah.
Former governor, he was a conservative.
Yeah.
But you could reason with him. You could sit down and discuss with him. These people are regressives.
Yeah.
If we identify ourselves as progressives, the opposite of progressive is regressive.
Now,
they
Joe,
want to go back.
Yeah, and back in 1981, when Lee Atwater, after he had finished basically running Reagan's campaign, he said, N-word, you can't say that anymore. And this is 1981. He says, by the 60s, we were talking about forced busing. He said, now we've reached a point, I'm paraphrasing here, but you can find the clip,
I
don't have time to play it.
On my show.
Yeah, and he said, but now we're to the point where all we have to say is tax cuts, and people know that hurts black people more than white people, and right. So, you know, it's this the new code.
It was the Southern strategy. It was the Southern strategy when Dixiecrats were upset because 50 years ago, the Civil Rights Bill was signed, and Johnson made his point. We did the right thing morally. We have lost the South. And so to attract the Southern Dixiecrats to the Republican Party, Lee Atwater created the Southern strategy. And what he said, because we play it almost every morning, he said, you speak in the abstract, and you get the same results. It's just that you speak in abstract. Paul Ryan. What is the difference between what Paul Ryan said about blacks not wanting to work and what Bundy said? Nothing.
Right. Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah. It's just and the Republican base gets that, which is the real tragedy. Joe Madison, Joe, keep up the great work, my friend.
I'm just following in your footsteps.
No, it's the other way around. Great talking with you, Joe. JoeMadison.com. Right. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Joe Madison, one of the greatest talk show hosts in America. Be sure to check out his show on SiriusXM. We'll be right back. And welcome back. And, you know, your thoughts on Donald Sterling and you know, what he had to say and what's going on, you know, give us a shout if you want. We'll get into that stuff. Right now, Andrew Campbell is with us, senior producer over at The Big Picture. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure. So, you know, we were just talking about with Joe Madison about how we don't live in a post-racial world. We're going to open the show tonight with that.
Yeah, we'll have a very similar discussion like you just had with Joe, touching on the latest controversy over Donald Sterling's racist remarks that were leaked this weekend by multiple media outlets, and what that really means about how far the U.S. has come and where does racism stand today. If you ask the Supreme Court, they would say that racism isn't a big deal, but it really looks otherwise with the latest stories coming from Sterling and Cliven Bundy. So we'll get into that with Reverend Lennox Yearwood, who is the president and CEO of the Hip Hop Caucus. We've had him on before. He's a great guest. So it should be a good conversation.
Andrew, would you please pull for me the clips of Lee Atwater and Paul Ryan?
Sounds good.
That Joe just referred to, so that I can play those for the Reverend tonight and get his take on them.
Sounds good.
All right. And then in Block B, we're going to get into the Koch brothers and why they were pushing that whole Cliven Bundy thing.
Yeah, we're going to get more into the story. This is something that you talked about last week as well, and we've been speculating that the Koch brothers were really pulling the strings behind this whole operation. But we're going to be speaking with Lisa Graves. She's the president of the Progressive, Inc. and publisher of the Progressive at PR Watch. She knows a lot about Alec. And we're going to be talking to her about the Kochs and Alec's role in the media circus that Cliven Bundy stirred up.
Yeah. Well, they were on the website, alecexposed.org, too. Yep. And then in Block C, When Cheap Fashion Kills.
Yeah, When Cheap Fashion Kills, we're going to be talking to Miss Bob Land. She is the founder and CEO of Manufacture New York. And we're going to really be addressing, it's the one-year anniversary since the horrible and devastating Bangladesh garment factory fire. And really, there hasn't been much change since then. What Americans don't realize is we get our clothes from over there, and yet we show very little concern to the safety and working conditions that these people have to work in. And if we're going to continue to get our clothes from these factories, then we should be the ones responsible for improving the conditions that these people have to work in. It's a very simple concept.
Yeah.
And that's what we'll be talking about.
Okay. And then in Block D?
In Block D, we have Everything You Know Is Wrong on What Does It Really Mean to Be Happy. We'll be talking to Professor Daniel Habron. He's the Associate Professor of Philosophy at St. Louis University and should be something, a very interesting thing. I know you're interested in it, so it should be a conversation.
What's his, in a sentence, what's his take on happiness?
Basically, his take on happiness is it's not really as clear cut as people think it is. I mean, there's always been these studies that say money will make you happy, money won't make you happy, this will make you happy, that won't make you happy, and it's really, there's a lot more to happiness than meets the eye.
Yeah. Okay.
So it should be very interesting. Everything You Know Is Wrong. And then in tonight's Daily Take, you'll be talking about how if George Bush never went to war in Afghanistan, every American who's eligible could have a free college education today.
Yeah. And in fact, we'd have money left over.
Exactly.
Yeah. Amazing. It's really amazing. It's really amazing. Andrew, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks, Tom.
I'll see you tonight. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. What a week, actually. I mean, we had Cliven Bundy all last week. And now it turns out the Koch brothers front group, Americans for Prosperity, has scrubbed him off their website. But they got this serious, Alec, the American Legislative Exchange Council, has this serious thing going on out west about basically snatching Western lands from the federal government and giving it to the states, so that the states can give it to people like the Koch brothers, or so it would seem. And then of course Donald Sterling. I mean, let's assume for a moment that Limbaugh is right in that this guy actually is demented, that he's in the early stages of some kind of dementia. He is 70-something, isn't he? I don't know. Whatever. And, I mean, that's not that old. But, you know, some of these Alzheimer's and some of these really nasty diseases can just whack you at any age, and you just never know. But in any case, let's assume that he's demented. That doesn't mean he's not a racist. It doesn't mean that he's not presenting a worldview that, you know, maybe a lot of guys, white guys sitting around, you know, with a can of beer in their hand, in their undershirts, watching TV, have, but they don't own an NBA team. And they're not a slumlord. Racism at its core, in terms of impact on society, in my opinion, and I would love to hear yours if you think I'm wrong on this, racism at its core is not so much about, although it includes, but it's not so much about being aware of racial differences, of the differences of race. That person has a different skin color than I do. Maybe they dress differently, or that, you know, there are some cultural differences, whatever it may be. And it's not just, I'm not just talking black and white, you know, fill in the blank, right? It's not just about that. And it's not just about any one particular race looking at other races and saying, you know, we're superior to them. I mean, that's something that, for example, well, I probably get into examples at my own peril. It's not just about that. It's about acting on it and having the power to act on it. And that's where it becomes a whole different thing. That's where it moves out of the realm. And by the way, you could say the same about sexism, about women earning 70 cents on the dollar that men earn and that whole thing. People are welcome to have their opinions. You can't stop people from having their opinions. Some of their opinions are going to be repellent. Some of their opinions are going to be abhorrent. Some of their opinions are going to be bizarre. When we as a society, and we as a society, you know, should do everything we can to try and kind of clean all that up. And I think that, for example, something I didn't experience in school, but Louise, my wife, did. She went to a basically all-white high school in East Lansing, Michigan, a university town. And they had a black awareness class when she was 13 or 14 in junior high school. And for a whole year, she had to study black history. And, I mean, she's still telling me stories from that. It woke up this little white girl who had never actually interacted with black people before, to the, you know, to what their experience might have been like in some small ways. So with stuff like that, I mean, we should be doing just simple stuff like that. You know, there's all this sturm and drang about God in our schools and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, sure, we should have comparative religion in our classrooms, but we should also be talking about race in our classrooms. We should be talking about it in the context of the history of America in our classrooms. And the history of America, you're going to teach an American history class, a good chunk of it should not just be the history of the rich white guys. It should be the history of, I mean, and we're talking American, and we're talking the continents of the Americas. It should be the history of the conquered peoples, of the first peoples in this country, in this, both this country and South America. It should be the history of the conquerors and some of the horrors that they committed. It should be the history, you know, of slavery. I mean, we should be teaching comprehensive history. But most important, at the legislative level, we're going to do things about things. It should be in the context of who has the power, who has the wealth. And you and I all know it's largely the white male power structure in this country. Who has the power, who has the wealth, and how can we put specific protections into place so that that power and wealth can't be used to promulgate racism?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And how do we not just call out people who are racists, who have the ability to do damage, but slap them down? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program, fair and only slightly unbalanced. A lot of folks want to weigh in on this whole issue. Racism in the previous couple of weeks, the comments made by stupid old white guys, basically. I don't know how to characterize it other than that. There's a certain element of the Wizard of Oz here. You know, Toto came in and pulled the curtain back. And now we're seeing the Republican base. As much as Rush Limbaugh would like to call Donald Sterling a Democrat, and he may be, I don't know. But it's still, this is the Republican, this is the worldview of the Republican base. It may be the worldview of some, no doubt, is the worldview of some Democrats as well. And I'm talking about white people here. But it is the Southern Republican base, no doubt about it. Anyhow, speaking of the South, Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles. What's up?
Hey, how you doing today, Tom?
Good. You?
I'm okay. I could be better. I'm kind of disappointed of Donald Sterling. And, you know, even if he was a Democrat, there's no room for that. It doesn't matter what, you know, political party he's in.
Yeah. Isn't it better that it's out now? I mean, you know, he paid these people over $2 million to go away who sued him for housing discrimination. He's been famously quoted numerous times making racist comments. Now he can't hide from it any longer. And it seems like this is a useful contribution to the American dialogue. You think I'm wrong?
No. I think you're right. My thing, though, is, you know, the Supreme Court just last week, I think it was last week, right, when they came out and said that, you know, we don't have to worry about discrimination, and they got rid of affirmative action.
Right, in Michigan. Yeah.
Exactly. And so this is a direct contradictory to the Roberts Court, and this is what I've been preaching for the last couple months. We Democrats, we really have to show, this is our time, that we have to show up and vote this November. We have to make it known that this Roberts Court can't stand, because we need to have a progressive court. With a progressive court, we can open up so many things. We can change so many issues by actually giving our, our views a chance to flourish in this country, and we can set a direction. But what the players did yesterday, to me, I kind of lost respect for a lot of them. I know they said that these guys are supposed to be role models. But for my community, I'm thinking, well, this is an opportunity to set a precedence, or just to open up everybody's eyes and say, well, we want to not only be treated fairly, but we want the respect, you know, from other communities. And yeah, to go out there and still play for this guy that says, well, he's feeding you, he's clothing, that's basically what he was saying in the rant.
Yeah,
and
but they did. I mean, they did turn their jerseys inside out and in the warm up. You know, I mean, they made a statement. They also not only are very highly paid, but they also have a contract. I mean, if they refuse to play, arguably he could sue them for an enormous amount of money for breach of contract.
Yeah, but I mean, how much do we? Okay, are we selling our souls for money? Is it all about money?
Well,
I mean, you know,
yeah, okay, good point. Good point.
Yeah, I mean, it can't be. We have so many people in these communities out here that are suffering because of some of these institutionalized racism, that somebody has to make a stand. And one more thing.
So you think the player shouldn't have played?
No, I don't think so. Because he needs to, because it would give a direct impact on the money that's coming in. I mean, imagine if every player, or at least every game is supposed to go through this NBA postseason, which way to make the most money off of advertising. If these guys was to sit out a half or even a quarter, you know the type of turmoil that would cause. They would actually want to kick Sterling out, whoever it is, these owners are, because it would be costing them money, and that's what it's all about.
Well, that's happening right now. The advertisers are bailing. He's going to be out, but like Joe said, he's going to be out with $1 billion in profit. It's amazing.
And one more thing.
Yes, sir.
And one more thing, Tom. I'm sorry. I don't want to fall for the okey-doke, but I remember all through the Bush administration, if Al-Qaeda would send a message, they would always say, okay, well, give us 48 hours to authenticate it. We don't need 48 hours. We already know. Give us 48 hours or give us time to make sure that there's Donald Sterling's voice. No, we already know. We can already tell. You know, I'm not even familiar with the guy, and I could tell that's his voice. So basically, they're stalling for time. They're always good for that, just like with Sean Hannity. He has nothing on Obamacare, so what they do? They put this other Bundy guy on there. They're just stalling for time until they can come up with another, you know, scandal.
Yeah, well, I don't think anybody anymore, Charles, is saying let's authenticate it. I think that Sterling, having come out and said these remarks don't represent who I am, when he could have said I didn't say this, is pretty much an admission that they are his remarks. Charles, thanks a lot for the call. It's always nice to hear from you. Martha in Michigan City, Indiana. Hey, Martha, what's up? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Well, you're welcome. I love listening to you. We miss you very much live in Grand Rapids, Michigan. But back to the topic. I noticed something in what he said when his wife, I think it's his wife, asked him, well, do you hate your players? Are you prejudiced against your players? And his response was, you know, I give them food. I give them homes. You know, I give them their cars and this, you know, through their labor. No. The players give him food.
Right.
The players' labor gives him home.
Right.
So anybody that thinks he's a Democrat, no.
Yeah, no, this is plantation owner mentality. You're absolutely right. Well said, Martha. And it was his girlfriend he was talking to, not his wife. Thank you very much for the call. David in Victorville, California. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. Now, this is interesting that we have these two different type of personalities sort of voicing what's in their minds, in their hearts. A cowboy and some metropolitan basketball team owner.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm of the mind that I would love to know what's in a man's mind and heart. So I kind of appreciate these two guys in a way of speaking. Now, because black people, I think we're not paranoid. We're not losing our minds. We know that this is a prevalent spirit and thinking and attitude that is still deeply rooted in the consciousness of white America.
Yep.
And so now I would prefer, I think Bundy and this fella, right, to just voice it. I want white people to speak what's in their heart and what's in their minds. Now, we can be offended by it, but I would prefer to be offended by the truth of what you think and what you feel, as opposed to you smiling in my face and being politically correct.
Yeah, and that's where, if you go back to that 1981 Lee Atwater quote that Joe Madison said he plays on his show almost every morning. That's great. That we've played on this show many times, where he says, you know, now all you have to do is talk about tax cuts, and everybody knows that's going to hit black people more than white people if you're giving tax cuts to the billionaires. And he said, you don't even need to mention race anymore, essentially. And still, you're pulling the racial string. You know, you're still making the racial dog whistle. David, thank you for the call. Well said. Sanchez in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Sanchez, what's up?
And Dr. Hartman, a good day to you as always, senor.
Thank you. And to you, too.
Well, I've been on hold here. I just received the latest breaking Donald Sterling news. Would you like to hear it?
Sure.
According to Donald Sterling, he's just announced and ordered the Staples Center from now on, starting tomorrow at the championship basketball game, only crackers are to be served in the VIP guest box.
I love it. Thank you, Sanchez.
Yeah, but I actually did want to tell you, relate some information here, because have you had a chance to listen to both parts of that recording that was released?
Yeah, I have. I think so. I've heard three different, you know, kind of came out in dribs and drabs over the weekend, but I think I've heard the whole thing, yeah.
Yeah, the latter part is especially telling, and I really hate admitting this, but Mr. Sterling sounds a lot like my late racist mother, Very much so, because he uses a few code words, and I also have to say that my daughter is Blaxican, just like his girlfriend is. So the conversation that was relayed between the two of them, I'm very, very familiar with. In a nutshell, Mr. Sterling is behaving like a coward within the white male power structure, not to defend his racial prejudice, but he's very weak. He's explaining that he says he does, you know, it's obvious that we're living in a hard, hard world, but he claims that he doesn't want to change that culture, and he says it in a very, very wimpy manner. It's as if, yes, he's a racist, yes, he's a scumbag and a slumlord. Oh, and by the way, did you also know that the NAACP was about to give him a Lifetime Achievement Award?
I know, and they're going to pull that. But, you know, I don't disagree. It seemed to me that there was almost an element of jealousy to what he was saying. Which would be coming out of weakness.
Yes, because he can't be real against the rest of that white male power structure that he has to deal with, because it is his friends and his associates and the rest of the members of the elite power structure, the elite mafia, that he has to contend with. And those are the racial people that are giving him the hard time, and that's why he came down on his girlfriend, telling him that I don't want them. Notice that he did say, I don't want them bothering me. It's like he's taking orders. He can't stand up to the rest of these people. And so he's showing a great weakness about this.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Maybe jealousy is the wrong word, but I get your point. I get your point, Sanchez. Thank you very much. Very, very informative. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I am learning from my listeners, and very much appreciate it. That was very insightful, Sanchez. Thank you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Joe in Lake Elsinore, California. Hey, Joe. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I've just called to say, you know, today's Holocaust Remembrance Day, and I think that's something that we should remember as well. You know, Sterling is an old man of old ideas.
Yeah, his 80th birthday was this weekend.
Right. And, you know, I think a lot of these attitudes that you've seen over the years are demonstrated by those attitudes that came from the greatest generation. And I don't want to beat up on the gentleman that, you know, I really don't know, but I do suggest that we should know more about what he does. As I was telling the call taker, the University of California, Los Angeles, has quite a relationship with this gentleman. It's a full-page ad in the business section where he's going to be thanked, or is being thanked as the largest ever gift donator to their basic kidney research. And he's going to have a gold-colored plaque placed in the lobby of this building. And they're also planning on naming a research lab in his honor. Mm. Well, I mean, I've spent a lot of time at the University of California. I think that's a little rich, if you ask me, because, you know, it's just...
Well, you do that if somebody gives you enough money. I mean, basically, you know, wings are for sale and plaques are for sale. I mean, there's just basically a price tag on all those things. You know, if you give $1 million, you get this. If you give $10 million, you get that. You know, if the guy's worth $1 billion, $1.9 billion, I guess, is what he's worth, not to mention what his team is worth, you can buy a lot of cred.
Yeah. Even Netanyahu ought to think about this a little bit. Because
I'm sorry. You're fading out, Joe. Joe?
I'm sorry. Yes.
Get up on your microphone. Now you're fading out to the point where we've got you turned all the way up, and I can't hear you. Oh, we lost him. Okay. Well, let's try Don in Long Beach, California. Hey, Don.
Hello, Tom. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
Tom, firstly, everyone I meet who desire to know politics, I give them your radio ID. If they want to learn politics 101.
Thank you.
Secondly, I'm a daily listener, but a first time caller. And my statement concerns the NAACP.
Mm-hmm.
And in the offering to offer this man an award, knowing his feelings and actions concerning blacks and minority. And thirdly, I am surprised that the black populace is surprised concerning this white American mindset concerning blacks. I just felt like all black America know how whites feel about America.
Oh, I think so, too. I think you know, actually there's some truth to what Limbaugh was saying when he was like, you know, why is everybody in the media acting astounded by this? You know, everybody has known all along that this guy thinks this way. And by the way, I'll add something that Limbaugh didn't say. But I've said it many times just today, This thinking is, and Clive and Bundy's thinking, reflects a large chunk of the Southern Republican base, and by intent. Richard Nixon intended to reach out to these people. Ronald Reagan intended to reach out to these people and feed this kind of prejudice, and a small portion of the Democratic Party as well.
Tom, this mindset is not pervasive just among the hello?
Yeah, I'm still listening. We're running out of time.
This mindset isn't just pervasive among the Southern blacks. This is pervasive throughout the United States of America. But
yeah.
I encourage you to continue what you're doing, because I am daily in Politics 101 listening to you.
Okay, Don, thank you very much. It's so nice to hear from you. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. And I think probably this worldview is held by whites all over the country. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and Derek in Denver. Hey, Derek.
Hi, yeah, thanks. Tom, you're disappointing me. I used to listen to you a lot and used to be a pretty level-headed guy, but, you know, you're jumping the shark on this racist thing. I mean, you know, I don't hear you ranting and raving every time a liberal racist says something racist. Where were you when Joe Biden said that, you know, Barack Obama was the first clean and articulate black person to run? Where were you with Bill Clinton?
He didn't say the first. He didn't. And I condemned that. Derek, here's the difference between Democrats and Republicans on race. Both parties have racists. Both parties have people in them who are going to say absurd things. The Democratic Party has worked for the better part of 50 years to normalize race relationships and to balance the power structure between whites and blacks in the United States, with the voting rights issues, with economic issues, with equal opportunity issues, with civil rights issues. These have all been promoted by the Democratic Party, and they have all been fought tooth and nail by the Republican Party. The Republican Party has consistently done everything it can to stop those kinds of things from happening.
That is absolutely false.
Okay, give me one example. Give me one example of a time when the Republican Party fought for the principle of defending the powerless in the United States.
Well, you just disagree with...
No, give me one example.
What to do it.
I just gave you five, six examples of the Democratic Party. You give me one example from the Republican Party.
I'll give you plenty of examples of the Democrats...
Give me one example where the Republican Party has worked to help people who are minorities or disenfranchised. One example.
Enterprise zones. School vouchers.
These are things where you prey on poor people. You're talking about tax cuts to corporations to come into neighborhoods.
Okay, but you talk about policies that cynical white Democrats used to foster racism, so that they could keep a particular group of people down.
So you share Clive and Bundy's perspective that if somebody is unable to find a job.
You're being lazy, Tom. You're calling me a racist. Why are you calling me a racist?
I know. I'm saying you share Clive. I'm saying that what you said is the same thing that Clive and Bundy said.
Do you have the intellectual ability and honesty to directly address my point, or are you just going to call me a name?
Your point was the Paul Ryan, Clive and Bundy point, that African Americans
Tom, you're being dishonest. Don't lump Paul Ryan with Clyde Bundy. That's like lumping you in with Adolf Hitler or something
How is Paul Ryan saying that we have a problem with men in the inner city, in the urban areas, not having the work ethic? How is that different from Clive and Bundy saying the Negro in St. Louis doesn't have the work ethic because they haven't learned to pick cotton? How is that different?
That is nothing different than Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton have said about the same group of people. You just want to take that same statement and call
your political difference, Derek, is that Clive and Bundy and Paul Ryan have never, ever in their lives fought for black people. And Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton have spent their entire lives fighting for black people. You may not like what they have to say, but I think it's really important that we start looking at people's actions.
Yes, look at their actions. So you just said that Paul Ryan's a racist.
No, I said that when you said
oh, come on.
That,
you know what you're doing.
Yeah, no, Paul Ryan, I don't know if Paul Ryan is a racist or not. I can tell you that he's calling out to the racists. Absolutely.
Oh, that's, you know, I'm calling out to the racists. You talk about dog whistles. Every time the left comes out and says, oh, you criticize Barack Obama, you must be a racist. You're against food stamps, you must be a racist. You're against welfare, you must be a racist. That is bigotry, that is intellectual laziness, and is dishonesty.
Derek,
and,
you're creating a straw man. I've never said any of those things.
You're
what I've said is that when people want to use dog whistle politics, when they want to call to the racist base, they use those kinds of phrases. The fact of the matter is that more white people are on food stamps, more white people are on welfare, more white people are on government assistance than black people, although the percentage is higher in the black community. And that's because Republican policy, Lyndon Johnson cut poverty more than in half in the black community in the United States, cut it in half altogether in 6 years. The Republicans fought it all the way, tooth and nail. Tell me. Anything. Well, Derek, I think we're starting to repeat ourselves. Marcia in Englewood, Florida. Hey, Marcia, what's up?
Hi. I just wanted to say that you guys need to remember that the worst racist there is in this country right now is Justice Thomas, who could have changed the vote and didn't for his own people.
I can't judge Justice Thomas. I don't know what's in his heart, but I know that many African Americans share that sentiment, at least have shared it with me. I can't speak to him though. Marcia, thank you for your call. Tom in New York City. Hey, Tom, thanks for watching Manhattan Neighborhood Networks. What's up?
A pleasure. You have made a comment about happiness, implying that happiness is something to strive for. But the fact of the matter is, happiness has nothing to do with striving. It is not a goal. And it can't be. And I can give you an example of proof that that's the case. Just read the diary of Anne Frank. The diary of Anne Frank shows a 13-year-old that really is happy, living under the worst circumstances that anybody can live.
I don't disagree.
So don't think of and don't preach that happiness is something to achieve.
When did I say that, Tom? What am I missing here?
You asked somebody, what does he think about happiness?
Oh, what that was in the show promo. I was asking, you're talking about when I asked Andrew what the guy...
You asked him what was his position on happiness.
Yeah, I see. Okay, well, Tom, that's a segment that's going to be on our TV show tonight, and you'll have to check that out to see what our guest has to say about it. Because all I was asking my producer was, what do you think the guest is going to say about happiness? And my producer said he's going to say that it's complicated, or maybe not. It was a very ambiguous answer, frankly. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show. So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and... In the face of all these interesting comments that are being made by people like Cliven Bundy and Donald Sterling. Another set of interesting comments are being made by, in this case, our old friend Jerry Corsi, Jerome R. Corsi, the fellow who wrote the book Swift Boat Veterans for Truth and exposed John Kerry's phony war wounds, and then wrote the book about how Obama's birth certificate was phony. He's back. Jerome Corsi, a senior staff reporter for WorldNet Daily, author of numerous best-selling books, including his latest, What Went Wrong? The Inside of the GOP Debacle in 2012, WND.com, of course, the website. Jerome Corsi, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be back with you.
Thank you. I understand that your latest research shows that not only, maybe I don't know if you've moved on from the Obama's birth certificate was phony or not, but now you're asserting that his mom actually isn't his mom and his dad wasn't his dad?
No, Tom, I'm reporting on Michael Shrimpton.
Okay.
He is an attorney in London who is was indicted for a law in London where you can't make a report on a terror or other threats, really bomb threats. You can't make an official report to the police if it turns out to be a false threat. And he reported a threat, nuclear threat, to the 2012 Olympics in London and was indicted for doing so because obviously it's a nuclear attack did not occur. I think it's going to be very difficult to convict Shrimpton under this law, and one of Shrimpton's many charges is that there is a DNA test existing by the CIA of Obama's DNA and his mother, Ann Dunham, which Shrimpton asserts shows that the mother is not the actual natural mother. And the reason I reported on it is because part of the defense in this case is going to be Shrimpton's ability to ask for documents, and these Obama documents are part of the documentary request he's going to make. Now, whether the court allows him to subpoena records out of the CIA, a British court, I don't know. But, again, it's interesting that this I was reporting what Michael Shrimpton has done. He's the one who's asserting that Ann Dunham is not the natural-born mother.
Well, and with your Swift Boat Veterans, you were reporting what some of those guys were saying, and with the earlier birth certificate stuff, you were reporting what some other people were saying. I get that.
Well, I mean, also, Tom, remember, when I did the Swift Boat book, I had done John O'Neill was actually commanded Kerry's boat. He's my co-author. And I had done the research on the Kerry's participation. The second half of the book was all my original research, or at least primarily, because, you know, even when in the 70s, when the work I had been doing in universities, I had established that Kerry was meeting with Madam Binh, who was chief negotiator of the Viet Cong during the Vietnam War, while he was yet in the Naval Reserve. So a lot of Unfit for Command was my original research, and a lot of the birth certificate book was my original research. I was the one who really documented that Ann Dunham left Hawaii within weeks after the baby Barack Obama was born and did not stay in Hawaii until Barack Obama Sr. from Kenya left to go to Harvard, which was 2 years after the baby was born. So there's a lot of that. Both of these books have included a lot of original research by me.
Okay. So here's my question. Why is it, in your opinion, that nobody has, at least to the best of my knowledge, nobody has ever questioned the pedigree or legitimacy of any of our white presidents? We get a black guy in the White House.
That's actually not true, Tom.
Okay. Correct me.
I mean, well, Chester Arthur was one who still has been questioned and who ended up destroying a lot of the birth records because I'd have to go back and research it precisely, but I think there was, again, a problem with his father not being a U.S. citizen when he was born, and that was an issue at that time.
Well, there have been five or six presidents who had one parent who was not a U.S. citizen.
Oh, and there's been five or six instances. You know, Barack Obama is actually the first African-American that was questioned on this, but there's many candidates, including John McCain, who was questioned by the Democrats in 2008.
Oh, it's nothing like this, though, Jerry. Don't you think the reason why your message was seriously questioned?
I can show you the New York Times articles, the Washington Post articles. It went on. Congress actually passed a resolution on John McCain, took the issue up in Congress, and voted that, you know, passed a resolution, joint resolution, that that John McCain was a natural born citizen. So there have been, you know, the idea that Barack Obama is the only one.
But see, that wouldn't even have been an issue if you hadn't been talking about Obama.
No,
don't you think,
Tom? That's not true either. The Democrats were questioning McCain independently and before, because remember the original questioning of Barack Obama's credentials in terms of birth credentials started with Hillary Clinton. She began the criticism. It wasn't me or anyone else. It came up during the debates, and the information was being circulated by the Clinton campaign in 2008. And at the same time, the Democrats were raising questions because John McCain was born in the Panama Canal Zone. And again, that was an issue as to whether he was a natural-born citizen. And I went through a lot of discussion and invitation. You know, I can show you law articles that were written on the subject.
No, don't you think, Jerry, that one of the reasons why this message that Barack Obama is illegitimate gets such resonance and gets such airplay and is frankly held by so many people, particularly white people, and particularly in the South, is because Obama is black, and that this is just at a certain level dog whistle politics?
No, I don't. I mean, you might try to make it that way, but it's not the case. The reason Obama's issue continues to resonate is because so many of the original documents have never been seen. In other words, even in April 2011, when the White House released the long-form birth certificate, what was released was a computer printout, which did not exist in 1961. The original documents...
Well, I don't have my original birth certificate. What does that have to do with anything?
Well, it has a lot to do with it, Tom, because the questions were in Hawaii that there were many ways to obtain birth certificates that were not necessarily... I mean, the Japanese have been doing it for decades, especially around World War II. And I researched that very thoroughly, that many of the Japanese born in Japan, but yet, you know, came to Hawaii, were being forced at the beginning of World War II.
So you don't think, I mean, you're immersed in this world. You live in this world. You don't think that there is a racist element to this?
I really don't. I think if Obama released all the original documents and the questions were answered, I don't think the, you know, questioning would continue. I put this much more in the category.
Jerry, I think you're terribly naive.
Well, Tom, you can call me whatever you want, but I don't believe it as a racial element. I think that the element of this is that there are unanswered questions. I mean, you've written extensively. I've written a book now on JFK's assassination. I don't think it was because JFK was had any particular...
We're not questioning the legitimacy of JFK as a citizen.
I'm pointing out, Tom, that, you know, the Warren Commission was tremendously flawed, and you had, again, a cover-up which intensified the...
Sure, but nobody was questioning his legitimacy as a citizen.
Nobody was, no. But I'm saying these issues arise, I think, including around Barack Obama.
So do you think, Jerry, just real quickly, we're out of time here, but do you think that Shrimpton's right, that Obama's mom actually isn't his mom?
I don't know. I think Shrimpton may be an interesting case.
Very. Okay, Jerry, we got to... Hang on just a second. I got to wrap it up. I want to bounce you out here. Hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Jerome Corsi, senior staff reporter with WorldNet Daily. His most recent book, What Went Wrong? The website, WND.com. Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, the newest birther conspiracy gets even stranger. It gets even stranger. Amazing. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV system. What's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, again, just a quick one. I truly believe, going way back, that racism stems from language. You know, usually people of different colors didn't speak your same language. And that, you know, if I can't talk to you, then I fear you. And do you think, hey, one second, or I think you are talking about, yeah. So if people can't talk to you, and when they're talking amongst themselves and they're a different color, then I think you're talking behind me about my back. What do you think?
I think you're close to something that's very real and that we don't discuss enough in America. There is an element of tribalism, for lack of a better word, that is probably inherent in human beings. It starts out with family. This is my family. I'm going to protect my family. I know who my family is. I know what my family looks like. And then, you know, this is my extended family. This is my community, that kind of thing. The thing, though, that and so then you go to income differences, class differences, and then you go to culture differences, and there you could argue that there's not much difference between class differences and culture differences, and then you can go to race differences, okay? And these are all levels at which somebody might perceive somebody else as the other. The thing that changes, the important distinction that I think is not made often enough, is the difference between racial awareness and the ability to create harm based on racial awareness. That latter is when it becomes racism. If you know, and this is why I have said in the past, and I don't know if you were the guy I argued it with or not, Michael, it was somebody, one of our regular conservative callers. You know, I said, by and large, it's very hard for a black person in America to be a racist, because by and large, black people in America don't have the kind of power that white people have, at least institutionally. They don't have the institutional power to back them up and surround them. They don't have the institutional power to know that the court system is going to treat them the same way that white people do. And to be a racist requires a combination of two things. One, that racial awareness. And so, you know, a black person can say terrible things, but, you know, what can they do to you? And number one, racial awareness. And two, the ability to act on it, the ability to do something about it. Am I making sense?
Yeah, and first off, I'm definitely not a conservative, but
just
think that if we all spoke the same language, you know, I don't care what color you are, as long as I can talk to you, I know where you're coming from, you know, and I just think that because language barriers.
But see, I mean, even thick accents convey culture, right? So, I mean, a white person from New York talking to a white person from rural Nevada. They are going to be acutely aware of the differences between them. And they're going to have opinions about the other. And that's not even getting into race, right? Or the same with you know, a black people who speaks with a black person who speaks with a thick southern accent as opposed to a black person who speaks, quote, American English, end quote, which is basically white English. But it's the power to oppress, which is where we really need to do something. Michael, thank you for the call. Back. Tom Harbin here with you. Yeah, this week I am traveling. On Thursday, May 1st, I'll be in Seattle at the Seattle Town Hall Center, Town Hall in the Great Hall. That is sponsored by Elliott Bay Books and Town Hall Civics Series. And I'll be talking about my new book, The Crash of 2016. The next day, Friday, I'll be in Portland, Oregon at the First Unitarian Church. And then also I'm doing a TED Talk on Friday. Or no, I guess that's on Saturday, the next day, I think. I'd have to look that up, but it's sold out in any case, so the TED Talk. And then a week from Friday, May 10th, I will be in Northampton, Mass. I'll be there for the PDA event, and then I'll be at the Parlor Room. We're going to do a book signing. It's free, but you have to sign up over at WHMP.com. So, anyhow, that's what's going on. Jerome Corsi, the very reasonable voice of what many would describe, and I would, as some really crazy stuff. And the entry point for some of that really crazy stuff into some very mainstream venues. I find it just fascinating. I always find it fascinating having conversations with folks like Jerry Corsi. TJ in Lithonia, Georgia. Hey, TJ, what's up? And thanks for listening to iHeartRadio. What's on your mind?
Wanted to go back to the gentleman who was kind of agreeing with Ted, not Ted Bundy, but the Bundy case, when he was basically saying that African Americans were lazy.
Oh, and then he said that he didn't say that, he didn't mean that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that it's just, I'm so sorry, just a second. The perception of that African Americans are lazy, it's something that goes beyond one or two individuals. It's something that even when people have the best of intentions, they tend to perpetuate it. Few people know that, I think this year, that African American women were the most educated by gender and race in America. And that African American men grow up in the same homes, but they just don't have the same opportunities.
Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with you, and I think that the dog whistle politics needs to be called out for what it is, which is what I was trying to do. But also, you know, when Paul Ryan starts talking about this, you know, these are horrible stereotypes that go way, way back. And Paul Ryan was quoting Charles Murray, who wrote The Bell Curve. And the bell curve is, you know, the hypothesis of the bell curve is that there's a bell curve to intelligence and that it's different for white people than black people. And, you know, which is a pretty grim, you know, and it's been totally debunked and disproven. But to have Paul Ryan quoting this guy, you know, Charles Murray, is just shocking. So, TJ, thank you for your contribution to that conversation. It's very, very much appreciated. Steve in Chicago, listening on CPT. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, I wanted to say a couple of things. One, with regard to a gentleman who called in earlier, I would say to him, in terms of, I know he attempted to use it at some form of levity, you know, referring to anyone as hacker, it certainly doesn't rise to the level of calling someone an N-word or using it in terms of a joke. But any sort of, you know, derogatory terms aimed at any group are in poor taste at best, and at worst are no better than, you know, the people that we accuse of engaging in that same sort of behavior. And I would argue that it has no place, you know, in a public airway. Having said that, I also think that there is a little bit of a sort of disconnect between, you know, some of the views that have been expressed. On the one hand, there have been people who called in, unless I'm reading it wrong, who are suggesting that, you know, that this view is pervasive, be it Calvin Bundy's view or the owner of the LA Clippers, that somehow 9 out of 10 white people in America hold to these views, as opposed to what I think is much more true, that in fact it certainly does exist. It does exist more in the South, but it tends to exist more in the Republican Party, but it is by no means the case that it is pervasive among white people. And when you look at all of the various studies and surveys that have been done, you know, when Brown v. Board of Education was decided, 9 out of 10 white people in America thought that segregation was something that they should be allowed to engage in, and if they wanted to send their children to an all-white school, they shouldn't be forced to integrate with black people or anyone else. Today, that's actually flipped on its head. 9 out of 10 white people think that it is not okay to suggest that you should be allowed.
Well, Steve, I think you're making the point that I was about to make in response to your assertion. I don't think that you can say something about all white people, but I do think that you can say something about that is consequential and significant, that is generational. And that is that people of my father's generation, people of Cliven Bundy's generation, probably the majority of white people of that generation hold the opinion that Cliven Bundy did. People of my generation, people who are in their 50s and 60s, probably half. People of my children's generation, people in their 20s and 30s, probably white people, probably 20-30%. Young people coming up now might be much lower than that. I think that this is one of the most rapid changes, and we've seen this, by the way, also with regard to opinions toward gay people.
Absolutely.
Just general tolerance. I think this is one of the most rapid generational changes we've seen in the history of America. And
you're absolutely correct.
And that's why there's so much blowback against it by the troglodytes.
Yes, absolutely. And I want to also make the point that I wish some of these issues were as easy and, you know, forgive the pun, of black and white, but unfortunately they're not with regard to the Supreme Court's decision in terms of affirmative action. Unfortunately, it becomes much more gray when you start to sort of dig you know, beneath the surface when you start to ask yourself, for instance, questions about affirmative action and to what extent it's effective in terms of the disproportional number of persons who are admitted.
Right.
Elite
right. And how do we do this? And how, you know, what's the appropriate way to do it? You know, the worst affirmative action program out there, Steve, is the legacy program, you know, the alumni program. That's keeping the most people alive.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with more of your thoughts on the news of the day and my thoughts, too. And I got a little bit more. Oh, by the way, Sterling is registered as a Republican. Uh-huh. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very lungeum. Honestly ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com. The good. Pope Francis. Earlier today, the Bishop of Rome, who has made a name for himself with his strong views on capitalism and social justice, sent out a tweet that is probably his sharpest worded critique of economic policy yet. The 7-word tweet is short and to the point. According to the Pope, quote, "Inequality is the root of social evil," end quote. I think Thomas Piketty, and Jesus for that matter, would have to agree. I hope every American politician who calls themselves a true Christian is paying attention. The bad. Harley Avenue Primary School. Every year, kindergartners at this Long Island school look forward to working on performing in a school student play. This year, however, that play isn't going to happen, and the reason why will shock you. Check it out.
Kindergarten show at the Harley Avenue School in Elwood has been a tradition for years. But this year, the district canceled the show. School officials explained to parents it was canceled because the kindergartners need to prepare for college.
That's right. School administrators canceled the Harley Avenue kindergarten play because they didn't think it helped kindergartners out with their college applications. This is getting ridiculous. And the very, very ugly Sarah Palin. During a speech at the NRA annual meeting in Indianapolis over the weekend, the former Alaska governor and 2008 GOP candidate for vice president let loose on how things would be different in America if she were in the White House.
If I were in charge, they would know that waterboarding is how we baptize terrorists.
Yeah, torture as baptism? I thought Governor Palin was supposed to be a proud Christian, not a sadist. With comments like that, she makes Dick Cheney look tame by comparison, and that fact alone is very, very ugly. Amazing. Okay, Jimmy in Ketchum, Idaho. Hey, Jimmy, what's on your mind today?
How you doing, Tom? I actually used to cook you lunch a few times a week at the Corvette Fish House in Portland for a year and a half.
Really?
So, yeah.
Wow.
I was going to ask you if you got struck by lightning in a library.
How cool is that? Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Louise and I used to love to eat
there. I'm sorry to cut you off. I have a point about the guy, Derek, that called using the same conservative argument you always hear about how Democrats are race baiting to keep the votes on their side. And this is exactly why that's racist. Not only are they ignoring their own party's completely obvious and blatant tactics to gerrymander districts and rig voting for minorities, they're trying to tell you that black people as a race are dumb enough to fall for a political agenda rather than to make up their own minds on issues that affect them personally and their families. And that's just blatant stereotyping. It's just horrible.
In other words, the assertion made by Paul Ryan and other Republicans that African-Americans who go on welfare are somehow being suckered by Democrats. The subtext of that assertion is that they're dumb enough to be suckered by Democrats.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a racist assumption. That's a very, very
drumming up racial tension and trying to, and that's why blacks will never vote for Republicans because the Democrats get them all riled up.
Yeah.
And just to assume that they're dumb enough to be riled up as a race is ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm with you. And Jimmy, thanks for a lot of good meals. That was during that a couple year interval there where where when we lived in Portland, where I was occasionally eating fish, and the Corbett Fish House is just the best place in town. Although you had great vegetarian stuff too, the veggie burgers.
Uh-huh.
Great stuff.
It was all good. We loved having you, too. I listened to you every day back in the kitchen. Those to have you come in was really nice. And I just tried my hardest not to bug you because I had 37 questions for you waiting when you came in. I'll leave Malone.
Well, thank you. That's...
Can I raise one more quick little point?
Sure.
This has always bugged me. You know, Citizens United, how come somebody hasn't brought up, lawyers haven't brought up the point that if they're using free speech as the reason that they can use money and all that, how can profits that are generated by an entire company from the mailroom secretaries on up be used to silence the voices of the very people that made that money?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the arguments that, or one of the counter arguments that John Paul Stevens wrote in his dissent on Citizens United, was that if a corporation is speaking, who is doing the speaking? Presumably it's not the employees. Presumably it's not the shareholders because they don't vote on that corporate speech. Therefore, it's a very small, select group of people in the executive offices. And don't they have the means and opportunity to speak on their own behalf? They don't need the corporation to do it for them, other than just, you know, using the power and money of the corporation. So, excellent point. Jimmy, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for a lot of great meals. The Corbett Fish House is also entirely gluten-free. That's one of the other reasons why Louise and I love to eat there. Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Oh, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, can I ask you a question before I ask you a question? On a Monday afternoon, do you ever feel like banging your head against a door jamb? You can't argue with ignorance.
Well, no. I always find it interesting to argue with ignorance. Are you talking about, well, what are you talking about?
Well, I mean, you field some really kind of like dumb questions, but the point is, I think that Clive and Bundy was picked out by the corporate media to advance their cause. And I was listening to the Newsday. I've been following us pretty good. We've talked enough. You know, my kids are in the service and my in-laws and whatever. I got a good idea. Why don't we drop all them militiamen out there in Nevada in the Ukraine? This stuff in the Ukraine seems to be ramping up. And Obama got criticized for saying, what, y'all want to... Why is war the ultimate answer? It's always the young people that go to bat.
Mm-hmm.
And I find the whole situation very confusing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I live in Central West Virginia, and, you know, Rush Limbaugh, and these people take him for, like, gospel.
Yeah.
And
well, that's because they're on every station in the country because, you know, they're all owned by a couple large corporations. Rick, thanks for the call. Let me tell you what's going on with Alec and the Koch brothers, apparently. The American Legislative Exchange Council has created model legislation that will, quote, demand that Congress extinguish title and government jurisdiction over public lands that are held in trust by the U.S. federal government. This is Alec called this the Eminent Domain Authority for Federal Lands Act. And in 2012, in fact, Utah's Mormon governor Alex supporter Gary Herbert signed the Transfer of Public Lands Act, mandating the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management relinquish their domain to Utah Republicans no later than 2015, or the conservative Supreme Court will do it for them. And, you know, there's a really good piece on this. Not sure where this originally came from. Oh, it's at politicsusa.com. I saw the excerpt of it over at democraticunderground.com. And, you know, basically the Kochs, Americans for Prosperity, Fox News, the agenda here was to give rich people more access to federal lands. And Clive and Bundy was the face of it. He was not a rich guy, so he was the perfect face. Here's a guy who's, you know, a small guy who's failing. Let's put him out there. And it's the billionaires behind it. And this is why Americans for Prosperity was tweeting all about it and doing Facebook stuff on it, all this kind of stuff. Paul in Federal Way, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi. I really enjoy your show, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk. You made a comment earlier that racism has two components, and one of them being the ability to enforce your beliefs. And I don't believe that. I'm very careful with that word, and I believe that to be a racist, you just have to believe that your race is superior to another race.
And you can be powerless and be ignorant and have that thought and have that belief system. So there are lots of black races, Asian races, Latino races, whatever race you want to bring up. And the other thing that never comes up in conversation, that race is a social construct. It has no scientific basis there, and it's been known for quite some time, at least over 50 years.
Right.
And we have much more in common fundamentally, than we don't as a human race.
Right.
That's
and,
the only race that matters.
And that's why race and class get so entangled. And all of these issues, you know, if we discuss only race and ignore class, we do so at considerable peril to ourselves. You know, Paul, in terms of just, you know, semantics, you're probably right, and I'm probably wrong. I would say that we need a more refined language in our discourse, because, yeah, there are people who are, you know, racially aware and think poorly of other races. And yes, they're racists. I don't disagree. But there are people who are racially aware, think poorly of other classes, and not only have the power to do something about it, but do. And we lack a specific word for that, which is why I'm trying to reinvent racist as for that. But yeah, do you have a suggestion?
That's a good question. I don't have a suggestion. I just think that the only suggestion I have is that we have a more educated citizenry that has a better scientific background and can recognize truth.
Yeah, there is no gene for race. There are only genes for individual characteristics in the body, but that's another one that most Americans are totally clueless about. Paul, thank you for the call. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is saying that if you are using the Internet Explorer browser, stop right now. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. What's up, Ed? 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 Okay, no Ed. Let's try Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Dave, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Tom.
Great.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine. I'm guessing Ed had his mute button on or something. What's going on?
Well, in my opinion, I think racism, hatred, intolerance, I think a lot of that is just fear turned inward. And I think a lot of it stems from the environment that you've brought up, you know, during your formative years. All the stuff that you get bombarded with, your peers and everything, you know, and you carry that throughout your whole life. And, you know, I'm about your age, and I know my attitudes have definitely changed throughout the years, and you know, I'm trying to be more tolerant. And the hardest part is, you know, facing your fears and, you know, confronting people that you know are racist, and they think that you think like they do, you know.
Right.
And it's that's a hard thing to do, but I really believe that.
That's what I was my conversation with Jerry Corsi. I was like, Jerry, don't you think that most people who are using your arguments, you know, even if you're not a flaming racist, your arguments are feeding that group? And he's like, no, I don't think so. I mean, yeah, but I don't think. Well, I can't say, you know, I'm not going to call one of my guests a liar, but I do believe strongly that these arguments, you know, that Obama's not, you know, a U.S. citizen or whatever, that really they're code for, have you noticed that guy in the White House is black? And it's just symptomatic of a larger problem that we have in this culture of not having reasonable discussions about race. So.
Yeah,
I'm with you. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Sue in New Eagle, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV on Dish. What's up, Sue?
Hi. I hope you and Louise and the family are well.
Well, Louise is home with the flu, but I think by tomorrow she'll be all better. She's on the tail end of it. But thank you for the well wishes.
Well, I'll send positive thoughts.
Okay, thank you.
A picture paints a thousand words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the pictures in our minds are what come to mind first when we hear or see something.
Right.
And so I think we need to change our framing of words. Left-handed, you used to be beat if you were left-handed. They tried to force you to be right-handed. So we call ourselves the left. We don't want to be the left. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
We want to...
But that's only meaningful to my father's generation. I mean, he was in school when they used to...
No, but there are a lot of us still around, you know?
Okay, all right.
Okay, right is good and left is bad, okay? The black hat and the white hat, cowboys, that's still going on.
Dick Gregory used to do some great riffs on that stuff, yeah.
Exactly, the bad guy and the good guy. So we need to change it to melanin challenged, that's the white, and melanin rich, that's the black.
There you go. Okay, Sue, I don't dislike it. I like it. I like it. I think the problem is most people don't know what melanin is. It's the pigment in the skin. But they might think you're talking about melanoma or something. But some variation of that, yeah. We'll be right back. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com with one of the most insightful, thoughtful, brilliant, extraordinary reporters working in America today, Victoria Jones. And I mean every word of it. Hey, Victoria.
Golly.
Thanks for joining us. So what's going on in the world?
Okay, I'm a bit speechless now, so...
Well, you write this incredible little news summary I get like 6 o'clock in the morning, and then you come on the program at 5 in the afternoon, and it's like you are so hardworking and you're so spot on, and I just really respect what you're doing, and I wanted to say it.
Well, I appreciate that very much because my hours are bloody awful, and I really appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
A suicide bombing at a rally in northeastern Iraq has killed 30 people, according to security officials.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it took place in the town of Kanakin, which has a large Kurdish population. They were gathering, actually, to watch TV footage of the Iraqi president, a Kurd, casting his vote in Germany. And at least 50 others were injured in the blast. Now, this isn't the only blast today in Iraq. There have been several attacks, and a total of at least 50 people have been killed in that country today alone.
Wow. Wow.
Quite extraordinary. This is a country that we're not talking about.
No. George W. Bush opened the gates of hell for these people, and it's still going
amazing.
On.
It's still amazing.
Going on.
Amazing.
Yeah.
New U.S. sanctions imposed on 7 Russian individuals and 17 companies that it says are linked to President Vladimir Putin's inner circle. The White House said the move was a response to Russia's continued illegal intervention in Ukraine. The announcement comes after the mayor of Kharkiv city in eastern Ukraine was shot and critically wounded. He is recovering, I believe, unless something has changed, after an operation to repair damage to the chest and abdomen, but his life remained in danger, the most recent bulletin that I have seen. The EU has also imposed sanctions on a number of individuals, Russian and Ukrainian individuals, and we'll have more details of what those are and who those people are coming tomorrow.
There was an interesting op-ed in today's Financial Times that sanctions are a fool's errand. Did you run across that?
I haven't seen that. I'm going to look that out.
The premise of it basically is that, you know, Russia only does a few tens of billions of dollars in business with us, but they do hundreds of billions of dollars in business with the EU and the rest of the world. And supply 15% of Europe's, you know, fuel. And if we think that we're going to use economic sanctions to change their behavior, we're crazy. That instead we should be collaborating with them to create a secure Ukraine, which actually Putin has been calling for. And the EU keeps saying, no, it's our way or the highway. And it was the first time I'd seen it in a, you know, that actually said out loud in a publication that's widely read, like the Financial Times.
Interesting. Was it an op-ed or an editorial?
It was an op-ed, I believe.
Interesting. I'm
it's on the front
up.
Page.
I like
the
FT.
Yeah. Yeah. I do, too.
Yeah. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and other leading Democrats are weighing the political implications of holding a vote on approval of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline as soon as next week as part of an energy efficiency bill written by Senators Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat of New Hampshire, Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio. The reason being, a vote on Keystone would offer a strong boost to red state Democrats in tough races this autumn, allowing them to defy the White House in support of a project that's viewed favorably back home.
Oh, man. I read, you know, I another op-ed I read today in the New York Times about how Kay Hagan in, was it North Carolina or South Carolina?
North Carolina.
How, because they're, you know, older people tend to vote more and they're conservative, that she's going to be in big trouble if she doesn't start swinging to the right. And, you know, you look at political races, and actually, if she swung harder to the left, more young people would turn out to vote for her. You know, she needs to energize her base, not become a Republican. And you know, forgive me, I'm going off on, because what you're... Yeah, well, it is, yeah. So I don't think that, you know, these Democrats in these swing states or whatever you want to call it, these at-risk Democrats, that voting for the Keystone XL pipeline is going to help them get elected. I think it's, you know, it's going to further depress the turnout of their base, and I don't think Republicans are going to give a rat's patootie about how they vote. They're still going to vote Republican.
Well, I think the Republicans are going to see it for what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is a huge mistake. These guys are listening to the same kind of Bob Trum, you know, political advice that lost 6 or 8 elections. I don't know how many Bob lost, but a bunch of them. But anyhow, back to you.
The Justice Department said today it's going to begin collecting data on stop searches and arrests made in 5 U.S. cities to weed out possible racial biases within the criminal justice system. Later this year, a nearly $5 million federal grant is going to be awarded to recipients who compete for funds to work with their local law enforcement to analyze arrest data and find ways to reduce any biases they find, particularly toward young minority men.
Wow.
So that's
Eric a substantial Holder, step.
It is. Eric Holder said the data collection is in response to President Obama's call for better relations between law enforcement and young men of color, following the not guilty verdict in the shooting death of black Florida teen Trayvon Martin.
Right. The other thing we need to do is go back to Bill Clinton's community policing, 100,000 cops on the streets, and, you know, walking the beat, getting to know the neighborhood.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference.
It really does. It really does.
Huge difference. Huge. And, of course, can't get away without talking about Donald Sterling, who is a Republican.
Yes.
Not a Democrat, and has given money to Democrats.
Yes.
Also,
decades ago,
sponsors are bailing on the Clippers very rapidly. Amtrak is distancing itself from the LA Clippers. State Farm, CarMax, Virgin America, Kia, and Red Bull. There may even be others at this point.
Wow. See, he's going to have to. Joe Madison was on the show earlier. He said that this guy bought the team for $15 million. If he sells it now, he gets $1 billion. So, you know, gee, let's all feel sorry for him. He's going to have to sell his team. Amazing. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
It's always nice talking with you. Thank you so much. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, So please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at tomhartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Well, it's been an interesting 2 hours. We heard from Jerome Corsi, who's got a new book out and new research indicating that perhaps Barack Obama's mother wasn't his mother. Not forget the birth certificate. And his father wasn't his father. And who knows? Maybe the guy got brought to this earth by the pigeons from the planet Xenu. The Department of Homeland Security has issued a formal alert. This Hannah Kuchler in San Francisco writing on the front page of the Financial Times, or at least the electronic version, U.S. warns web users to log off of IE, that would be the Windows Microsoft product. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has warned people and companies to avoid using Internet Explorer after a flaw was found in the popular web browser that has allowed cyber criminals to impersonate known websites to steal user data. There is no patch as of this moment. And if you have Windows XP, when a patch comes, it ain't coming to you. And 40% of the world is still using XP, including appliances and cash machines and all kinds of weird stuff. So this is not good. Cliven Bundy and the Koch brothers and Alec, it's all about taking public lands. That's an interesting story. We started out with Joe Madison at the very beginning 2 hours ago. Joe Madison, the talk show host over at Sirius XM, the Black Eagle, it's often called, talking about Mr. Sterling's latest rants. The Donald on Fox, one of the guys on Fox saying, well, our mail is saying that there are Twitter or whatever is saying that this guy was set up. And Donald Trump, he of the hair challenge, says, well, yeah, of course he's set up. I mean, it's terrible what he said, but, you know, this is the girlfriend from hell, words to that effect. I think what this does is it between Clive and Bundy talking about the Negro, and now Mr. Sterling asking his girlfriend not to bring black people to his games. And he's hemorrhaging now. His team is hemorrhaging sponsors. He's going to have to sell this team. And he might even lose $100 million in terms of the sale, although he bought the team for $15 million. So if he sells it for $1 billion and, or for $100 or $200 million less than that billion, you know, I'm not crying for him. But there are larger issues as well. I mean, we can talk about all these things, and we've been talking about race in America for the last 2 hours. But every kid in America right now could have a free public college education if George W. Bush hadn't been such a warmonger. Let me explain. In early 2001, before the war in Afghanistan, the Taliban government in Afghanistan issued an edict to ban opium cultivation in that nation, saying it was a violation of Islam. Opium, of course, is the raw material for heroin. And it worked pretty well. In 2000, roughly 4,500 metric tons of opium was produced in Afghanistan. In 2001, after that edict, that fatwa, the number plummeted to less than 1,000 metric tons. Price of heroin went up around the world. The number of addicts, particularly in Europe, Russia, and America, dropped. The Bush administration was so impressed by the decrease in opium production that they gave $43 million to the Taliban to encourage a continued halt in opium production. Now, while $43 million may not seem like a lot, let's put that in context. At the time of the deal, Afghanistan's total GDP was just $2 billion, putting it at the bottom of global GDP rankings. It was literally the poorest country in the world. So for the Taliban, $43 million was a lot of money. And George W. Bush's decision to fork over $43 million to the Taliban to help curb drug trafficking use and abuse was actually a good choice and smart policy. Now, fast forward to the days and weeks after 9/11. On October 14th, it's like 2 weeks after 9/11. No, it's like a month and a week, 5 weeks after 9/11. Senior Taliban leader, Deputy Prime Minister Haji Abdul Kabir, sent an official offer to Washington, D.C., saying that the Taliban would be willing to arrest and hand bin Laden over to a third-party country if the U.S. stopped the bombing of Afghanistan. Kabir said, quote, if America were to step back from the current policy, then we could negotiate, then we could discuss which third country, end of quote. But Bush, the same man who just months earlier had handed over a small fortune to the Taliban government, rejected this latest offer of cooperation. Instead, he took up a scorched earth policy and bombed Afghanistan back to the Stone Age. His decision to invade Afghanistan has cost our country over $713 billion since 2001. This for a country with a GDP of $2 billion. And that number is rising by the millisecond. In fact, every hour, the war in Afghanistan is costing we the people another $10.17 million. The Taliban offered to hand over bin Laden on a silver platter, but Bush said no, and now it's cost us hundreds of billions of dollars. But what if George W. Bush had taken up the offer from the Taliban and even sweetened the deal like he did with the opium? What if he did something similar to what he had done just months before and offered to give the Taliban money if they promised to cut down on terrorism and on Al-Qaeda's presence and influence in that country, just like they cut down on the opium? We could have given the Taliban $2 billion. Double that nation's GDP and make everybody in the country twice as rich, and it still would have only been a drop in the bucket compared to what we've spent on the war in Afghanistan. And if we had done that, we would have saved ourselves enough money to provide a free public college education to every single eligible student in America. As The Atlantic points out, according to the Department of Education data, public colleges across America collected $62.6 billion in tuition from undergrads in 2012. $62 billion. This means that the federal government would have to only spend $62 billion to make public college tuition free for every student in America in 2012. That's less than 11% of what we spent on the war in Afghanistan. Less than 11%. Bottom line, George W. Bush had a chance to get America's priorities right, and he failed. Now, the good news is he's not in Washington anymore. So instead of spending trillions of dollars on prolonging the Bush legacy of unjust wars and torture and all, why don't we spend those trillions on the things that will make America great again? Why don't we invest in our intellectual infrastructure and give every eligible student in America a free public college education? We could do it. $62 billion? That's nothing. I mean, seriously, think of it. It's a fraction of what we've spent just on Afghanistan. Add Iraq to that. So, anyhow, a lot on our plate today, a lot that we've talked about. And there goes my mouse. Charles in Chicago. Hey, Charles. You wanted to talk about...
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey,
good
Charles.
Afternoon, Tom. How are you?
Fine. What's up?
I just want to comment on a couple of things, and I'll try to be brief. I'm a little tired of all these phony patriots, not just saying what's on their mind. These people are racist, but they always have a way around it. I told one person who was a patriot, I said, look, just say it. Get it off your chest. You don't like President Obama because he's black. And he said, no, he's not black. He's half white. I have another reason to hate him. I'm like, look, you can't hide behind this.
Mm-hmm.
Don't. My father brought us up not to be hateful people, but not to love everybody, to be more analytical. I am not an idiot, and I would like to think that they're not idiots. But if they listen to the stuff that they say to each other, print, and spew to the public, they are racist. They are crazy, and they are anti-American. Now, if you tell me that Mr. Clive and Bundy isn't a crook, and these people who were coming out to support him with guns en masse, if you say that something was right about that, go put it this way. And I said this way before it happened. If it was a bunch of minorities supporting another minority because they thought they were wronged by the government and they showed up with guns,
there would have been a shootout. Yeah. They would have been taken down. I'm with you, Charles. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And not only that, every Republican in the country would be condemning them and saying they deserved it. And just, what was that group in Philadelphia where they firebombed them from the sky? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour. Maybe somebody in the chat room can remember. There was a group of an African-American group in, I'm pretty sure it was Philadelphia, back in the 70s. And, you know, when there were all these groups popping up with names like Symbionese Liberation Army, and the police firebombed their roof, and it burned down through this row house and killed a bunch of people. And, you know, the white press and all the white people were like, they had it coming. And, I mean, you know, yeah. If Clyde Bundy had been black, it would have been a whole different story. Glenn in Windsor Mill, Maryland. Well, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up, Glenn?
First, I want to say thank you for feeding into my greatest fear that I've ever had. When I was younger, my daughter used to ask me, why don't you want to be on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Because being African-American, I'd be afraid that for $1 million, I'd be asked a question like that, and I couldn't remember on the spot.
Okay.
And I would, but that's why I called.
Yeah.
The reason why I called, because earlier you had a gentleman talking about the impact of language on racism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in my 50s, and in the late 70s and early 80s, when I was apartment hunting and job hunting, people would hear my voice, and they would assume that I was white.
Mm-hmm.
And once upon meeting me, the job was always taken, and the apartment was always full or gone. They just leased it. I don't even know how many apartments were just leased within 5 minutes of me arriving there.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, it can diffuse situations because I have dreadlocks, and I encounter a lot of people, and their first impression of me with dreadlocks is that I'm one of them, whatever they are in their minds.
Right.
And once I open my mouth and begin to talk, and I have diction, or correct diction, or Queen's English, or whatever, then they're a little more easy. But I still will not get invited to a dinner party or anything like that. They're just more easy for that moment. They're convinced that for that moment, I'm not going to rob them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
that's where class intersects race.
Yes.
And it's almost like, you know, tribe intersects race because, and I mean tribe in the, you know, my group, your group, where are we more alike? Where are we more different? And I think that, I don't know how it works in the black community, but I can tell you in the white community that white people are more comfortable with a black person who speaks, as you said, the Queen's English, for lack of a better phrase, than they are with a white person who talks with a really, 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 really heavy Southern accent and,
right,
you know, might look like they're poor.
Yeah.
You know, if you had the people equally, you know, similarly dressed. So it's almost like it's become, as time goes on in our culture, in our country, it's almost become. Now, is that the same thing in the black community?
Yes, and also in the black, at least in my neck of the woods, yeah, we distinguish between a racist, a bigot, a supremacist. You know, do we have the slight subtle differences between an idiot and a moron,
right,
and an imbecile?
Right, right. Good point. Good point. Racist, bigot. Yeah. What I was trying to say earlier, I guess, is, you know, the racist is the one with the power. The bigot is the one who doesn't have the power. But anyhow. Thank you for the call. Thank you. Good talking with you, Glenn. We will be right back. Yeah. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Elizabeth in Farming Hills, Michigan. Hey, Elizabeth, you wanted to go back to my earlier, in the last hour, I made the comment that a racist, in my opinion, was a person who had a racial awareness, a sense of superiority, and had the power to inflict damage on people of a different race. And so there were very few racists in minority communities because they didn't have the power by and large. There are more racists in the majority community, in the white community. And a fellow called up and said, no, I think anybody can be a racist. You wanted to, and I said, well, we need a word then. And you wanted to contribute to that conversation?
Yes, I did, but
you ended up coming up with it yourself with the bigotry, being a bigot. It's a far richer reference to people that have difficulty including others. You know.
So would bigot be the almost a racist? That would be a bigot be, or I mean, is a person bigot if they're using their power to impose their racism and harm others, or are they a racist? I mean, which
yeah,
of these?
No, I agree with your final summation that the bigot doesn't really have the opportunity to impose his bigotry. He just holds it for himself and goes on and excludes and refuses, right. Is intolerant or not open at all to ever changing his position,
yeah,
or her position,
yeah,
on that. Where a racist, I think I agree with you there, racist is far more active, whether they're capable of it or include others in their racism, you know, try to enfold others in their racism,
right,
and maybe gang up. So, you know,
right, whether they're active or evangelical or,
yeah,
or they may,
yeah,
be violent. I mean, this
absolutely
is the one thing that a person who doesn't have means, whether it's a poor white racist or whether it's a black racist, but the use of violence would make them a racist because it moves them into the I can inflict harm arena.
Correct. Yes,
okay.
Yes, that's where I agreed with what you were saying as I waited to talk. The only other thing I want to throw in real quickly, I don't know, it's from 2008, so lots of your viewers or listeners may have seen it, but if they did, maybe revisit. There's a documentary out called Flow, For Love of Water. I really encourage people to take a look at it if they haven't, or revisit it. It's
okay.
Another log on the fuel to our extinction.
Is this about the crisis in fresh water around the world?
Yes, and
yeah,
the privatization of it, Vivendi and Suez, and these companies that are just confiscating.
Yes,
another part of nature.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I'll have to check it out, Elizabeth.
Thanks
for the call and thanks for the heads up. Great to hear from you, Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Carl. What's up?
Man, I tell you, the every time this racism thing pop up, it burns me more and more at our framers or founding fathers or whatever you want to call them, that this is something that they should have dealt with right then instead of kicking it down the can another 100 years,
yeah,
kicking the can down the road. And to answer your question, answer the question that you asked about 10 minutes ago about, you know, why don't they take the military money that they're spending for those two god-awful dumb wars and they put them into our educational system? Simple. The answer is this. You notice how whenever any city, county, state, one of the first things that politicians are willing to cut is in the educational sector.
Yeah.
And the reason why they're okay with that is, one, their children tend not to go to public schools. They normally go to private schools because they're a little more well off. Number two is they need a population that's not as educated as others. They need a generation of McDonald's workers.
Yeah, and this is how an oligarchy maintains its power. I would add a third thing to that though, Carl. Back in the 60s, the Republican Party clearly and explicitly and out loud identified the union movement as one of the major sources of money and manpower for the Democratic Party, and essentially declared war on it. They talked about it a lot throughout the 60s and throughout the 70s. They weren't able to really do much about it until 1981 when Ronald Reagan became president. And at that point, you had about a quarter of the workforce in the United States, the private sector workforce, was unionized. And Reagan declared war. He had actually cut a deal with PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, before the election. They endorsed him because he told them explicitly that he would not fire them if they went on strike, and he was going to upgrade the equipment in the air traffic control system. They went on strike, and he fired them. One of the first things he did, and it was a shot across the bow of labor, that he broke his promise, and he was going to take down the unions because the unions are the foot soldiers for the Democratic Party. And basically the three largest pools of union labor left in the United States are postal workers. It's the largest single pool of unionized work. And look at that. And look at, you know, since 2006, they put that poison pill in the postal reform bill to take down the post office, that they got to set $5 billion aside every year to pay for the retirement health benefits of people 75 years from now. Number one, postal workers. Number two, federal and state employees. And look at how Scott Walker and, you know, pick your state. The Republicans are constantly villainizing and demonizing government employees. And number three, teachers.
Absolutely. And I'll add on to that. And this right here is just a little nugget for you to show you how successful they've been over the past 30 years. I have a small business here in Nashville. One of the guys that worked for me, he's 22 years old. This guy, young white guy, he didn't know what a union or a pension was.
Wow.
He did not know what a union or a pension was. This is how successful they are. And this is what happened when you have government officials, particularly on the right, that want to do away with any and all education and they're not really wanting to educate the public here in America, because they want to keep them just smart enough to be mad at the other and vote for them, but just dumb enough to not know what a union and a damn pension is.
Yeah, I'm with you, Carl. I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. That's why we've got to have basically a revolution, not a gun fighting revolution, but we need a political revolution in this country. The FDR presidency was revolutionary. The Reagan presidency was revolutionary. It flipped from FDR's. And we need another revolution.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And hopefully in 2 years, we can get a president who can do it. Welcome back, Tom Hartman. Here with you. And no, Donald Sterling is a registered Republican, yeah. Well, but it doesn't matter. And an hour ago, I had a guy call up and go off on this. This guy gave money to Democrats. I heard on Rush Limbaugh, or words to that effect. Here's the deal. There are Democrats. And what about Joe Biden saying that Obama was articulate? Oh, amazing. There are Democrats who are racists and who say stupid things. There are Republicans who are racists and say stupid things. But the Democratic Party, at least since the 1960s, has been working, and in fact, I would say since the 1930s, but, you know, explicitly, clearly, definably, unambiguously since the 1960s, the Democratic Party nationwide has been working to minimize the damage of racism and the history of racism and genocide, particularly against African Americans, certainly not enough against Native Americans in this country. But the Democratic Party and its members have been, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, on and on the list goes, right? The very clear. The Republican Party, on the other hand, has done and Lyndon Johnson cutting poverty in half, more than cutting poverty in the black community in half in 6 years with the Great Society and the War on Poverty. The Republican Party has fought that at every turn. So, you know, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat speaking, whether Donald Sterling has given money to Democrats or whether he's a registered Republican, doesn't matter. The Democratic Party is about literally hope, change, and a better America for everybody, and the Republican Party is about hope, change, and a better America for rich white guys. And if you have some evidence to the contrary, please share it with me. But this is what I'm hearing from everybody from Paul Ryan to the commentators on the right, to the Limbaughs and Hannitys of the world. Anyhow, enough of my rants. A bunch of you want to get in here. Dan, Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Dan. Thanks for listening to M760. What's up?
How's it going? I talked with you last week. I'm attempting to run for Congress in the Colorado 4th District.
Mm-hmm.
And you said once I had my website up, give you a call back and you give me a little plug, which I greatly appreciate.
Well, you can give you a little plug. So what's your website?
The website is danchapin.com. Dan, C-H-A-P-I-N, just like Harry, just not so much so.
Mm-hmm.
And it's .com, and so
cool.
My platform out there, proposed legislation, things like that.
Great.
I'm also the first officially recognized endorsed candidate by the American Middle Class Party, or better known as AMP. We're all going to get amped and recharge the middle class.
Sounds like a plan.
And so basically I've got kind of a long road to hoe right now because of the way the election laws are written in most states, and Colorado's no exception.
Yeah.
I basically, to get on the general ballot, I have to run as a write-in candidate on the Democratic primary ballot.
Okay. Well, good luck with that. Dan Chapin, chapin.com is the website. Dan, thanks for calling back, and thanks for having the courage to run for political office. And whether you make it through or not, you know, a lot of people look at Abraham Lincoln's history sometime, how many elections he won, how many he lost before he became president.
Yes.
It all starts, you know, I mean, he lost most every election he had except for two. And so anyhow, Dan, I wish you the very best. You know, a journey of 1,000 miles starts and all those other cliches. You're doing good. Yeah. I wish you well.
I appreciate it. And to answer one of your earlier questions, I believe the group you were looking for in Philadelphia was MOVE.
Ah, I think you're right.
Yeah, and they had a big thing because they dropped a bomb from a helicopter on their house, and a lot of people died in the house. But worse than that, it burned down like the whole block and like 40 or 50 other houses. It was just a mess.
Yeah. Okay. Dan, thank you very much. Thanks for your history. Appreciate it. Tom, in Tucson, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on the website at .org. What's up?
Tom, since 1946, the generals and the politicians have spent untold blood, agony, and money on wars. Does this country need a military defense department anymore?
I think we do. I don't think we need the one we have. And I think that if we were to deprivatize it, it would just that simple act, just take all the corporate profit out of it, it would probably cost us about half of what it costs us. So, but I'm with you, Tom. I'm with you. We have, in fact, to a large extent, you could say we have an economy that's dependent upon war. If George W. Bush hadn't had his two wars, we would have had a very serious recession after 9/11, or depression perhaps, because this is how he spent. He borrowed what, $3 trillion for these wars. I mean, it's just amazing. Tom, thank you for the call. Frank, although he could have borrowed that money and stimulated the economy by building bridges and high-speed internet access and sending all our kids to college. We got $1 trillion worth of credit card debt worth of student debt. We could have just instantly wiped that out. We could have sent with a second trillion. We could have sent every kid in America to college for the next 5-10 years. Frank in Chicago. Hey, what's up?
Hey, earlier, and I'm sorry to go back an hour and 15 minutes. You'd come off of a break, and even before you knew that Sterling was a Republican, you said that it was like going to the Wizard of Oz, and Toto was pulling back the curtain, and you were seeing the root of the Republican Party.
Yeah, the base.
And not 5-10 seconds later, you said, well, he may be a Democrat. I don't know. But you were willing to perpetuate the lie to promote your liberalism.
But it's not a lie, Frank. Tell me any legislation that the Republicans have pushed and really worked for since 1960 that has helped minorities.
What I started the conversation with was the lie that he was the root of the Republican Party, and you admitting, I don't know.
I said I think that he is representing the base of the Republican Party. I still do. I think that there are Democrats who represent the base of the Republican Party. They're called Reagan Democrats. They used to be, the Democratic Party used to be the racist party. Back in the 20s and 30s, it was the party of the Klan. I mean, it almost doesn't matter. But but the point is that today's modern Republican Party is all about rich white people. They don't care about poor white people. They don't care about poor black people, and by and large, they don't care about any minorities in general. And the Democratic Party, since 1964, has been aggressively working to create equality of opportunity in this country, regardless of race, religion, and now even sexual orientation. The Republican Party has been fighting all of them tooth and nail.
And can you agree that the blacks in the country are not doing any better than they were 50 years ago? They have more out of wedlock births.
I don't know if that's true, and if it is, it may be numerically. But the fact of the matter is that Lyndon Johnson lifted a lot of black people and a lot of white people out of poverty with the Great Society, and then the Republicans went to work on that. And not just the Republicans. I mean, Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush did a good job of taking it apart. But then Bill Clinton, put the nail in the coffin by ending welfare as we know it, in quotes. And this has, but again, name one thing that the Republicans have tried to do since the 1960s that would increase equality of opportunity. If anything, they have fought against these things consistently.
LBJ could not have had the Great Society without the support of the Republicans. He had to arm twist his Democrats to get that passed.
His Southern Democrats, you're right. There were a lot of racist Democrats from the South back in that day, and those Democrats are now called Republicans in the South.
You are making my point, Frank. There's racists in both parties. Neither party has.
I agree with you. That is absolutely true. But the parties are fundamentally different in that the Democratic Party, since the 60s, has been working for racial justice and equality in this country and gender justice and equality and now sexual identity justice and equality. And the Republican Party has fought all of those. And I can give you chapter and verse. Can you give me one piece of legislation that the Republican Party has pushed that would advance the interests of minorities in this country? One.
When Ronald Reagan came into office, the economic incentives and programs he put into place helped everybody, irregardless of race.
They did not.
Did too. Black folks, white folks alike did much better.
Are you talking about the Reagan recession when we had inflation at 12% and unemployment at 6%? Actually, we had unemployment was as high as 9% during the Reagan administration. We had the biggest stock market crash since the Great Depression. I mean, it's like you guys have completely reinvented Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was not even popular when he was president. I mean, it's... Hey, Frank, thanks for the call. Good try. When you've got one piece of legislation, call me back. 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, you've even got Rand Paul out there now pointing out that Reagan, tripled the national debt, that he was a big spender, And welcome back, Justin in Woodland Hills, California, listening on TomHartman.com. Hey, Justin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
I just kind of wanted to touch on the history of Donald Sterling. I don't know if people really know his history with race, but about 10 years ago, he's a very large landowner, both commercial and residential.
Right.
And he was sued for discrimination mainly housing. And he lost in court, and it was the biggest judgment in California, and I believe it was for the entire United States, as far as monetary value goes. And at the time...
Are you sure he lost in court? The article that I read said that they settled out of court for $2-something million, and that was the largest settlement, but that he didn't actually lose.
Well,
he basically bought them off.
He went to court, and he was going to lose, and right. I believe that's when they settled out of court for it.
Sure.
And then the same thing happened with Elgin Baylor when he was the GM of the Clippers. Elgin Baylor's an NBA legend, and he also sued for employment discrimination, and... Right. I believe they also settled out of court. And, this whole thing should come as no surprise. It doesn't come as a surprise to me because I've lived in Southern California forever. But the big problem the NBA has, though, is they cannot force him to sell his team. It's not in the charter of the league, unlike Major League Baseball, like what they did with Marge Schott back in the 80s when, she was a horrible racist. And the only way to get for the commissioner to have the power – to force him to sell the team is the owners have to convene, and the majority of the owners have to give that power to the commissioner. And I don't personally see that happening because that might endanger them at some point in time. So, you know, unfortunately, a suspension is not going to do anything because he's still the owner.
Yeah.
And then a fine is not going to matter because the guy's a billionaire. I mean, he owns half of downtown Los Angeles. I mean, the Sterling Towers.
Why don't we use this as a teachable moment about the Green Bay Packers?
Yeah, exactly. Community owned.
Yeah. Why do we have billionaires owning football teams to begin with? Isn't this a, I mean, this is like the old, you know, when the gladiators used to fight in ancient Rome, they fought on behalf of regional governors who were basically the oligarchs of different regions. And we've reinvented that system now with football.
More indicative of pro sports, pro sports franchise now, you know, they ask the taxpayers to build these, you know, billion-dollar stadiums for millionaires.
Yeah, this is how George Bush made $14 million.
Yep. I think it's absolutely ridiculous that, you know, someone has to pay these guys, give them money or financial incentives because they say it creates jobs. Well, create some jobs, but they're mainly low paying. But, you know,
what they're mostly creating is giant Swiss bank accounts.
Pretty much. And the other thing I find indicative of this story, particularly, it's a reflection upon the entire country. It seems like since President Obama, since he's been elected, it seems like the racism has gotten worse and worse and worse. It's becoming more and more open. And it seems like it's, you know, a lot of these people, it's okay to be that. It's like now, it's okay to be a racist and to say this. And then they have these defenders come in for him, you know, the Donald Trumps and then, you know, the Fox News people. And, you know, they're saying, it was illegally taped. And, well, who cares?
Yeah.
I mean,
he was trapped or, you know, what a poor guy. Or Limbaugh saying, well, everybody knew anyway. What's the news? Yeah. Justin, thanks for the call. Again, I'm saying, you know, I'm not a sports fan. I don't know much about sports. But I do know about the Green Bay Packers. And I even though they're not what they used to be, you know, as much community owned as they used to be, it's time for us to talk about community ownership of sports teams. Welcome back, 10 minutes before the hour. And, interesting. Sarah in Denver. Hey, Sarah, thanks for listening to AM760. What's up?
Oh, I knew you were going to get me just as I was on my way out, and I can't speak freely, so let me go right back into the apartment.
Okay.
Make my dog wait. And come on, so.
Shall I put you on hold and come back to you in a minute, or?
No, because I've been on hold a long time, so
okay.
I want to get this off my mind. Come on, Sophie. Right. About that. Okay, Sophie, my tripod doggy is inside. You know, if I have the radio on in the afternoon, I have your show on.
Thank you.
I talk you up to lots of people that they got to listen to you. But one thing that you're doing is really, really ticking me off.
Mm-hmm.
And that is you keep talking about prejudice as if it's a one-way street.
No, wait a minute. Pause, Sarah. I acknowledge that there is prejudice and bigotry in all communities. What I'm talking about is racism, and my definition of racism is the ability to have having access to the levers of wealth or power so that you can use or express your bigotry in a way that harms people of other races. You know, that are,
okay.
So back to you.
All right. Well, I've never heard you say that there is prejudice from coming from the black community.
Of course, there is.
Okay. And but because I am in a senior subsidized housing that is a broken system in Denver, regardless of which senior subsidized building you're in and who owns it and who's managing it. But this particular building is 90% African American. 100% African-American management team and 100% African-American Methodist Church ownership. Now, the last building I was in, senior subsidized, was owned by the Catholic Church. That was worse. This is an improvement. Everything was going on in that other building, assaults, prostitution, drug dealing, astounding.
Mm-hmm.
What they're making
and I'm in contact with Senator Bennett and Senator Udall. I'm leaving subsidized housing. I cannot live like this.
Right.
But in this building, and they need to do some. The Democrat, if they're concerned about their seniors, then our two Democratic senators in Colorado have to do something about the broken subsidized senior housing, which HUD multifamily allows. But this particular building is 100% African-American management company, and I had to file a discrimination claim against them with Colorado Civil Rights Division under DORA because they refused to assign me a parking spot, and I'm a disabled 67-year-old senior female.
Right.
And they had about five in which they could have assigned me. So the management team is racist because they do have the power.
Yeah, if you're right that they did this because of your race and they did have the power over you, then you're absolutely right. And I'm not saying that there's no racism in the black community. And I'm certainly not saying that there's no prejudice or bigotry in the black community or Latino community or Asian community or Native American community. I mean, pick your women relative to men. I mean, pick your minority group. It's all there. What I'm saying is that generally speaking, the access to the levers of power and wealth, the court system, control of the court system, control of wealth and control of power are in the white community. You're the exception that proves the rule. Sarah, thank you for calling. I don't disagree with you if what you're saying is true. Bill in Albuquerque, listening on KABQ. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, I'm retired. I was a controller during the strike.
Ah, back in 1980.
Supervisor.
81.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, you were absolutely right. Very few people know what you said earlier. Reagan cut a deal with Patco. Patco is one of the only labor organizations that endorsed Reagan during the election, and he stabbed him in the back.
Yep, you're absolutely right.
And you are, very few people know that.
Well, thank you for calling and acknowledging it, Bill. We need to point out more and more frequently how Reagan stabbed everybody in the back ultimately. Bill, thanks for the call. Ed in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, the Beatles said happiness is a warm gun. Now, I'm not sure about that part of it, but the fact of the matter is that our African-American population has been the backbone of our freedom since 1676, when Nathaniel Bacon had his rebellion and threw Governor Berkeley, the English governor, out of the colonies, threw him right out of the colonies, started the Revolutionary War right then, because the upshot of that whole deal was July 4th, Governor Berkeley hung black men and white men on the same gallows. And I'm here to tell you that started the Revolutionary War. It took 100 years from there. And we've still been fighting British Petroleum, BP, for God's sake.
Yeah. So you're saying that African Americans helped build this country and have been among the greatest builders and defenders of this country.
You're darn right. I don't care what you say. The 333rd outside of Bastogne, the 565th inside of Bastogne, they were these African American soldiers were dropping shells right onto Tiger tanks. And
wow.
You can't do that unless you have people out in the field who are.
Oh, you're talking about in World War II? Yeah.
Yes.
I'm with you, Ed. Ed, thank you very much for the call. Thanks for your comments. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to have a conversation with economist Dr. Stephanie Kelton from the University of Missouri at Kansas City about how to get to an economy that works for all of us. Plus, is America no longer a democracy? A new study says it's only a democracy for an elite few. I'll speak with study author Dr. Martin Guilens at Princeton University. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy some. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.